Today, meeting the scientist who is investigating why sperm counts are in decline and trying to find out what we can do about it. When you were younger, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you have a dream job?
I was actually a child actress.
Really?
Yes. And I did quite a bit of acting. But after a while, I just decided it wasn't for me because I couldn't take the rejection.
Gone from stage to sperm, I suppose.
Not too many people know that, actually.
Dr. Shanna Swan had an unconventional start to a career which is in itself unconventional. She's spent the last few decades investigating sperm counts to try and find out why among Western men they have almost halved in the last 40 years.
And that's why I'm talking to you and talking to many people, saying that we need to become aware of the seriousness of this problem before we can make change.
One in six couples now have trouble conceiving. And through her research, Shanna has discovered one big reason why. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how everyday chemicals might be threatening the fertility of the human race. Shanna, I feel like it's not news to many of us that fertility is declining. It's been well reported in recent years that people are finding it harder to have children. But I think we usually talk about this in terms of women's fertility and about the age many women are having children now. But actually, what your work looks at is whether this could be because of falling sperm counts. Can you remember when you first discovered this or first came across this?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I'm not saying that this is only due to the male factors, okay? Fertility is a couple enterprise, you know, having a baby is a couple enterprise. And so both are equally important, actually. But when I first became aware of this, I think was when I read a paper that was published in 1992 out of the University of Copenhagen, which stated that sperm count had declined dramatically over the past 50 years. And that paper was viewed with a lot of skepticism, including mine. And so I did this epidemiological analysis of the 61 underlying studies that had made up that Danish study, because I was very interested in whether I could make that decline go away.
Well, yes, exactly. It's the sort of thing you'd want to make go away. You say you were skeptical when you first came across that paper. After you'd gone through all those other studies, what did you think about this idea of a falling sperm count then?
Well, when we completed that analysis, which took 6 months, by the way, and I included two collaborators to check everything because it was so important, the surprise was that the slope of the line describing the decline had not changed at all. It was remarkably stable. And it turned out that sperm has been counted the same way for a very long time, since the early 1900s. So that wasn't a problem. So after that, I thought, wow. And then why?
Okay, so the data you were looking at meant that everything was consistent. When you realised this, that this report was right and sperm counts were declining, did you feel like you'd found something very significant, but that not many people were talking about at the time?
Yes, I did. And that was why I went to the considerable effort of getting a large amount of funding to do this next study, because, you know, the next step question had to be, why?
Shanna did a study which looked at the sperm counts of men living in rural areas compared to men living in cities. What she found was that men in rural Missouri, where there's a lot of farming involving pesticides, had half the number of healthily moving sperm than those men living in urban Minneapolis, where there was less exposure to those chemicals. So after that study, were you pretty convinced by what you'd found?
Yes. Environmental exposures could lower sperm count.
You've been doing this research for many years now. What is the current situation? I mean, how fast are sperm counts falling?
In Western countries, what we found was that when the study started in 1973, there were a median, that's a midpoint, of 99 million sperm per milliliter. It's a concentration, right? 99. Think of that, about that number. And then in 2011, which was the last year of sample collection, there were 47 million per milliliter. So a drop of about 50% in 39 years.
Wow. I mean, that sounds like a big drop, but 47 still sounds like a very big number.
The number 47, and that was actually in 2011, so it was 10 years ago, is very close to a very important number in semen analysis research, which is 40. The number 40 million per milliliter has been shown to be the point at which the time to conceive a pregnancy increases pretty dramatically as sperm count drops lower than that. And when you get below 40, you're in a, if you will, a subfertile range where it's not impossible to conceive, but it takes longer.
I mean, this sounds very dramatic, Shanna. How worried should we be about this?
I think we should be worried about this, actually very worried, but not only about sperm count or quality. I think we should also be worried about other problems of male reproductive health, for example, declining testosterone levels, which affects many aspects of men's and women's health, by the way, including sexual libido. And we should be concerned about the increasing rates of miscarriage and the increasing numbers of women who, when older ages, have fewer eggs than they would expect. That's diminished ovarian reserve. And in general, the state of reproductive health in humans is pretty low. And by the way, that's also true of non-human species. So I think we have a really serious global problem in reproductive health.
After you did that study in Missouri where you found that exposure to pesticides was causing sperm rates to fall, you went on to investigate in more detail the chemicals that can affect fertility rates. What did you find?
The ones that do this have a particular property. They have the ability to disrupt the body's natural hormone system. And those are called the endocrine disrupting chemicals. Phthalates, which make plastic soft and flexible, and the bisphenols, which make plastic hard. Now, this is not by no means the whole story or the whole cast of characters that can cause harm, but I have focused on these, and most particularly the phthalates, for about 20 years.
Right. So what you're saying is that chemicals that can be found in everyday objects can change what is happening in our bodies.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, what kind of products are we finding these chemicals in?
So these chemicals we call everyday, everywhere chemicals because they are. But when you ask what are they in, what products are they in, then you have to go to the specific chemicals. So phthalates, I said, make plastic soft and flexible. So immediately, if you look for soft, flexible plastics in your life, you'll see a lot of them. Anything that goes through a soft tube, tubing in a milking machine, think of tubing in a food processing plant. The phthalates, which are not chemically bound to the plastic, leave the plastic and enter the nutrients or the food and then get into the body. And that's been shown most dramatically, I think, in the newborn nursery, where urine has been measured for phthalate metabolites and shown that those phthalates are directly linked to how many lines are coming into the baby's body, delivering nutrients to the baby in, for example, a NICU, neonatal intensive care nursery. You know, studies have shown that food is a major source of phthalates in our body. So it could be plastics in the processing, in the shipping, in the storage, in the cooking, then cosmetics. Because another thing that phthalates do is they increase absorption into the skin, and they increase the retention of scent and color. So that would be, you know, why they're put into fragrance products and colored products like nail polish and lipstick. They're in polyvinyl chloride. So anything that's PVC, whether it's a hose in your garden, or it's PVC flooring in your home or in your walls or anywhere in your furniture, the phthalates will be there and they will leave. They off-gas, they go into the air, they go into the dust, and they go into our bodies.
I mean, Shana, you can't see at the moment, but as you were just talking then, I was looking around my room and seeing many of the things that you were just listing off, and it's becoming even more horrified. This is all around us, isn't it? We can't get away from this stuff.
Right, right.
How do the chemicals in these everyday items that we're surrounded by all the time, how do they actually affect change in our bodies?
The way they cause damage is that they interfere with hormone signaling. And hormones are needed to govern, if you will, direct the action of development in utero and then in adult life, childhood and adult life, and function. So development and function require the right hormones at the right time.
So what you're saying then is we're all governed by hormones which are released at the right time for our body's development. And then these chemicals arrive and confuse our cells, which can disrupt this.
Most sensitive period is early in pregnancy, when cells are extremely rapidly dividing, and the organs are being formed under genetically programmed code. Of course, it's all timed. And so, for example, the male genital tract requires a certain amount of testosterone at the right time to develop normally. And if phthalates interfere with that, which they can do because they're testosterone lowering, then the male doesn't get the testosterone he needs to develop properly, and he will be not be completely masculinized.
Wonder if you could explain, Shana, what work have you done has proven that chemicals like the ones you've mentioned affect our fertility?
I studied the risks of phthalates because of rodent studies. So phthalates were shown to cause a syndrome in males. It's called the phthalate syndrome. And it works like this. The rat is fed phthalates in their food, that's added to their food, the mother, when she's pregnant, in early pregnancy. And then when her pups are born, the males and females are examined. The females are not affected by this exposure. And the males have these conditions of their genitals, which together comprise the phthalate syndrome. And this has been shown many, many times in animal studies. I was very, very impressed by this because I read this at the same time that I learned that phthalates were in everybody's body, including the bodies of pregnant women. And so I said, okay, if we're exposed to phthalates, are our boys also being born with the phthalate syndrome? And I followed that question for almost 20 years.
How did you go on to investigate that in pregnant women?
The model is you take pregnant women, you get their urine, you store it, the babies are born. You analyze the urine for phthalate metabolites, and then you measure lots of endpoints in the children, and then you relate those measurements to the mother's phthalates. And so you have a path between exposure and outcome. These measurements are predictors of later sperm count and fertility.
Okay, so there are measurements you can take of a baby which are directly affected by how many phthalates their mother was exposed to during her pregnancy, and which also tells you how fertile that baby will grow up to be. What are these measurements that can tell you all of this?
One in particular called the anogenital distance, which...
What is that?
Yeah. So what is that? The anogenital distance is something, it's the distance from the anus to the genitals, just like it says.
I see. But it is, yeah, makes sense.
It is not something that people know about, but it is actually something that is, in the US anyway, has a lot of names on the street. So young people.
Does it?
Yeah. So it's it's called the taint. And the
taint.
Taint and the grundle and the gooch.
The grundle.
And the gooch. Those
oh,
are
the gooch. I know the gooch. I know the gooch. I think actually we use that for other things here, but you don't choose to use any of those words. You just call it the AGD.
Yes. Yes. This is a remarkable measurement. And there's three reasons it's remarkable. It's remarkable because it is so different in males and females. It is 50 to 100% longer in males than females. And there's nothing else in the body that's that different. If you think about the difference in height or weight or skin fold thickness or whatever in males and females, nothing is 50 to 100% different, right? And the other reasons it's amazing is it turns out that it tells you how much testosterone the fetus was exposed to. And this is true in males and females, by the way. So we can't look inside the womb, right? It's a black box. There's no way to go in there to measure testosterone. But this AGD is so sensitive to testosterone, both on the male and the female side, that when the male is exposed to less testosterone than he's expecting, his AGD will be shorter. And if the female is exposed to more than she's expecting, her AGD will be longer. The third reason it's remarkable is that it predicts later function and fertility. So we showed that when this AGD was shorter in adult men, they had a lower sperm count.
Right. And as you've already said, testosterone levels are affected by those chemicals we've been talking about, phthalates. If we know that these substances affect us in this way, why are they still in so many products that we use?
I think they're still there because we haven't made a loud enough noise as a society to get them removed. Getting them removed is extremely difficult. There's a lot of forces at work keeping them in our homes. And some of those are economic, some of those are habit.
Is the, you know, the chemicals lobby, is that part of the reason why things are not changing faster?
Definitely. Definitely. There are huge economic forces that are preventing change or preventing proper regulation.
How are these chemicals currently being regulated?
That depends on where you are. In the EU, they do a much better job than, say, in the United States. And I'll give you an example. In cosmetics and personal care products, there are only 11 chemicals banned in the United States and over 1,100 banned in the EU.
Gosh.
The other major thing is that EU has a program called REACH, under which chemicals must be shown to be safe by the manufacturer before they are introduced into commerce. We don't have that in the United States. So here we kind of have, you know, the Wild West. You let them all out there and let them shoot it out and see what happens. That's kind of the attitude here. And so it takes somebody like me and my colleagues to actually see what the chemicals are doing to people. And each examination of a single class of chemicals and a single category of outcomes takes 5 years and costs $5 million.
Are we safe in Europe then?
Well, safer, I would say. If you talk to people in the environmental groups in Europe, you will find a lot of a feeling that there's a lot more work to be done.
And what is that work? You know, what should we be doing to regulate these even further and protect ourselves?
The way they're tested has to be changed, because really the way they're tested doesn't keep us safe. And that's because they're not tested at human exposure scenarios. So how are we exposed? We are exposed to lots and lots of chemicals at very low doses. And to understand why that's important, think about medication. So if you go to get a new prescription from your doctor, she will ask you, what else are you taking? And that's because she knows that this new medication that she's going to be adding could affect the action of those other chemicals, and that together they could be harmful. That's not done for chemicals. Chemicals are tested one at a time. The other sort of major problem is that we do not test for low doses. And surprisingly, perhaps, it's not always true that more of something is worse. And if that's not the case, then you really have to test at both ends, both at low doses and at high doses. And that's not being done.
Why isn't this happening? Why is this a difficult thing to change?
It is a difficult thing to change because the paradigm that what's called the dose makes the poison is centuries old and has been used forever. That's always been the guideline. And so you could test at very high doses, drop the dose until you didn't see any effect in the animal, and stop, because you will assume that if you go lower, you're safe. And that's not the case for these hormonally active chemicals in our environment.
Coming up, these chemicals are everywhere. So how do we keep ourselves safe? These chemicals are around us, and depending on where you live, they'll be regulated in a different way. So I suppose the thing for everyone is to work out how we can sort of protect ourselves from them. How do you think we can do this? Can we do this? And, you know, what do you do to protect yourself?
We really cannot do very much because most exposures are hidden. We can only deal with exposures that we know. But what we can do, you should, as much as is possible, your food should be unprocessed. That is, not in a can, not in a bottle, not in a plastic container. Partly that's because of the container itself, and partly because of chemicals that are introduced during processing. So another thing we can do is to be careful about the chemicals we put on our skin and the personal care products. And that's difficult because a lot of ingredients are not labeled, but there are groups, and we give some references to those in Countdown, where you can go on the web, you can put in the name of this product that you're wondering about, and it can tell you something about its safety. So those are two easy things to do.
Okay, so for some people, giving up a lot of food they like to eat, and in my case, maybe having to completely rethink my skincare routine, which is a shame. I mean, what happens, Shanna, if we don't do anything?
Things are getting worse, definitely. And we know from animal studies that if we stop exposure now, if we could stop exposure now, that our reproductive health would be restored to its levels several generations ago, if we could stop exposure for three generations. That's a long time, but that's a goal to work toward.
Shanna, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Shanna Swan. Her book, Countdown: How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race, is available to buy now, and you can do so via guardianbookshop.com. Thanks to Shanna for speaking to us today. This episode was produced by Lucy Greenwell. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.